Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. While the first manned flight took place in 1903, it wouldn't be until World War I that aeronautical advances were made that would turn aviation into more than just a county fair spectacle. While many men contributed to moving manned flight forward, and many men lost their lives in the process, during this period, there were three men in particular who stood out. Eddie Rickenbacker, Jimmy Doolittle, and Charles Lindbergh. All three men made important contributions to aviation before, during, and after World War I, and all three men became financially successful, world-famous celebrities. When World War II erupted, all three men were middle-aged and wealthy. They could have easily sat out the war while younger men fought, but they all answered the call to duty and provided their talents as ace aviators to the Allied cause. My guest today on the podcast wrote a history of Rickenbacker, Doolittle, and Lindbergh. His name is Winston Groom. He's authored numerous history and historical fiction books, including Forrest Gump, you've probably heard of that one, as well as the subject of today's show, The Aviators, in which he details the engaging history of these three pioneers of flight and their service to their country. Today on the show, we discuss each of these men and their respective heroics, from Lindbergh's famous flight across the Atlantic to Doolittle's legendary raid on the Japanese and to Rickenbacker's survival at sea for 23 days during World War II. We also dig into their complex characters and specifically Lindbergh's testy relationship with the press and how his initial opposition to the U.S. entering World War II got him labeled a traitor by FDR. Winston is a masterful storyteller, so you're in for a real treat today. You're going to be left both entertained and inspired by these three men. After the show's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/aviators, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Winston Groom, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you are a prolific writer of history, historical fiction. I'm sure our listeners are familiar with Forrest Gump. One that I just read, just walked away, blown away, because I knew very little about this part of American history. The book is The Aviators, where you focus on three pioneers of aviation, James Doolittle, Charles Lindbergh, and Edward Rickenbacker. Before we get into the lives of these men, their contributions to aviation, I think it's important for our listeners to have a little bit of background of what aviation was like before they came on the scene during World War One. What was flying like before World War One? And I mean, did it serve any practical purpose?
It was the kiss of death.
It was the kiss of death. Okay.
Yeah. They were learning by doing. You know, there wasn't really, there was no aeronautics or anything. And you know, once you get up in three dimensions, you're in a whole different scale of things, and there's a lot of things that go on up there that don't go on here on Earth in a four-wheel car, and so they had to learn this stuff literally seat of the pants, what to do and what not to do. And so a great many of these people perished. I mean, one that comes to mind that I wrote about in my novel El Paso is that, I can't remember her name now, great aviatrix, and she died because she wasn't wearing a seatbelt, because of an argument at that point, I'm guessing around, 1910, whether the seatbelts were dangerous, because if you crashed and burned, you couldn't get out of the plane. She was an exhibition over Boston Harbor, and the plane turned, and both she and her passenger fell out, 3,000 or 4,000 feet into the into the harbor and died. So that was that kind of thing. It was learning by doing.
Yeah, and it seems like a lot of the early years of aviation, a lot of it was just like barnstorming. It was just like shows. It was more just entertainment purposes, really.
Aircraft was not reliable enough. And this actually went for after World War One as well, but it just wasn't reliable enough for passenger service because the weather was a deciding factor. And things like fog caused the pilot simply to bail out. I mean, there was no, you know, if you go into a fog, you know, there's no telling what you're going to find because your instruments weren't accurate enough. A doodle solved that problem, but that was much later. And so you couldn't have, say, a flight from even Cleveland to Chicago because you couldn't say it with any kind of regularity whether it would get there or not. The mail was the first test of this, the U.S. Air Mail. And a lot of the pilots, matter of fact, they said it was basically a suicide club. I think 70% of all the air mail pilots they had back in the 1920s died in crashes. So it was a very risky business.
Yeah, and because it was risky, did it draw a certain type of person?
Oh, God, yes. You know, you're daredevils, of which there were many. You know, they were fearless people, obviously. You know, they had put aside that notion of self-preservation for the privilege of, you know, being up in the air like Batman or something.
Seems like a lot of them came, they were like race car drivers. A lot of them were race car drivers before they got into it.
Yeah, well, of course, certainly Rickenbacker was. He was the greatest race car driver, one of the greatest, before he took to flying. As a matter of fact, he owned the Indianapolis 500 Speedway at one point.
Yeah, that's right. We'll get into a little more detail about these guys, Rickenbacker and Lindbergh and Doolittle. And they all contributed to aviation in different ways. And we'll talk about the different ways they did that. But as you researched and you wrote about them, what do you think they all had in common? I mean, I'm sure fearlessness was one, but anything other attributes they all had in common?
Yeah, they had a drive to not just be better, but be the best. And it sort of snowballed along the way. As they got better, they strived to become the very best. And they were the very best in what they did. And I think that is something that doesn't limit itself just to, say, aviation, but it's in all things, all matters. Excellence. I was just talking to having dinner with a pilot last night. He's a colonel in the Air Force and now flies private planes. And he wondered about Einstein and what propelled him. And we started talking about it over dinner. And, you know, he had an obvious aptitude, Einstein did, for mathematics. But he wanted to, he could see into the future. He literally could do that and see into outer space where the rules don't apply. There's no Newtonian physics don't apply in outer space because there's no gravity. And it's a very special thing when you find such men, such people.
And I thought it was interesting, too. Like, they all came from relatively humble beginnings as well. I mean, I guess Lindbergh might have been middle class, but they were humble.
Certainly. Well, they were. And matter of fact, they were. Well, with the exception of Lindbergh, they were lower middle class. Doolittle was from California, in the Los Angeles area, and his father abandoned the family when he was very, very young, and was raised by his mother in almost impoverished circumstances. He made his way as a boxer. He was a small guy. He was only about 5'6", but he was a very good boxer. He actually turned pro professional boxer in California after winning the state championship. But he then applied himself at the University of California and got a degree in engineering. And ultimately, he got a PhD degree in aeronautical engineering from MIT, which is one of the best schools, you know, engineering school, probably is the best engineering school in the world. And so he knew whereof he spoke. Eddie Rickenbacker is very similarly came from, he was from Columbus, Ohio, and his family had immigrated, parents from Switzerland. They were poor German Swiss who, in those times, back in say, the 1890s, I think, they could never get out of their class, which was essentially a farmer, a peasant's class. In Europe, that ability didn't exist. And so they immigrated to the United States. I think his mother came with a note pinned on her saying who she was and where she's going. She didn't speak English. But Rickenbacker's father was, he was killed early on in a fight, again, raised by the mother. I think that if I'm not mistaken, Columbus was where the original soapbox derby was run, or it was somewhere there in Ohio. And he entered that, and he won that, and then he took to car racing. He was fascinated with the automobile. And as we talked about a minute ago, he became, I think he was third in the world somewhere along, however they measured that. He, in World War One, he wanted to get into the war. He was very famous by then as a race car driver. Somehow finagled his way into becoming a driver. They made him a sergeant, and he was a driver of Billy Mitchell, who was a famous aviator who was court-martialed for promoting aviation too strongly. And through Billy Mitchell, he got to be a pilot and then wound up shooting down more German planes than any other American, at least, and became the ace of aces. And Lindbergh was probably raised in a more financially secure position. His father was a congressman and had actually done very well. But then he lost his money, I think his father did, in some agricultural adventure, and he lost his seat in Congress, and the father sort of abandoned the family. He managed to get a little bit of college training, but again, he wanted to fly. He watched these air, Minnesota or Wisconsin, I can't remember which, but he was out in the woods and look up in there and see an airplane and think, I want to do that. And he scraped up $500 to buy a used training plane, one of Curtis Jennings from World War One, and learn how to fly it himself, I mean, without any training. He just thought he knew how to do it. That's how these guys grew up.
That's how they got into flying. Well, let's talk about Rickenbacker. So he was an ace of ace, but he, in the process, he made a lot of contributions to aviation and was able to propel the force. Like, what exactly was Rickenbacker's role in promoting or making advances in aeronautics during World War One?
Well, I don't know that he made a lot of advances in aeronautics in the First World War, but he certainly pushed the envelope so far as being a fighter pilot. He had, if I'm not mistaken, 21 victories, which means he shot down 21 enemy planes. And I remember one time he tore into a squadron of 7 enemy fighter planes just by himself. He so terrified these people, they all flew off in another direction just because he was bold. But he had a way of suppressing his fears to the extent that he said he never was afraid when he was there. It was always so many things to watch out for, to do. But whenever he came down and landed, he was in an aerodrome in France. It was a wall that he'd go behind the wall and throw up. And then he started to shake. And then he'd go into the officer's lounge and have a drink. And that would kind of put him back on an even keel again until the next time. But that was, you know, it was a scary thing what he did. But then, of course, afterwards, you know, he became the owner and the president of Eastern Airlines, and he did a huge amount of promotion of commercial flying. It was just enormous. He was a worldwide known figure. in commercial aviation. Everybody knew Eddie Ruckenbacker.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time I ever heard of him, but he was, because of his race car driving, because of his exploits during World War One, he was world famous. He was a celebrity.
Oh, God, yeah, I've got a set of glasses that belonged to him. He would give them out from Eastern Airlines, and it says, "Compliments of Captain Eddie Ruckenbacker." He always wanted to be known as Captain Eddie.
So he contributed a lot to dogfighting, like how we fight in the air, and then also commercial. Let's talk about Doolittle, because unlike Rickenbacker, who was a celebrity even before he became a NASA ace, Doolittle, he had to earn his celebrity after World War One. So what was it that Doolittle did that basically made modern aviation possible that we know today?
Well, he was so good as a flying cadet, that they made him, during World War One, they made him a teacher, an instructor. He never got into the action. He was furious, but that was the way it was. But he stayed in the Army, stayed in the military, and until the 1930s. And at one point, he became a household name because of his flying abilities. They used to have races. I think they still have a few of those. But these pilots would race around big pylons, and people went, it was a blood sport, people went to see him crash, you know, kind of like these car races they have today. But they, in fact, they did crash too much, and he won all of those prizes, and at last he announced that he was getting, and very publicly announced he was quitting. He said, "I think aviation, we've done enough to promote aviation in these kinds of races, but now we need to promote aviation safety, and this isn't the way to do it because we're losing too many people." And that was pretty much the end of the big-time plane racing. But what he did was he realized, like all of them did, like Lindbergh and Rickenbacker, that the aviation was so limited by the weather that they needed some way to overcome it. And the only way to overcome it was instruments. And basically what he did, what Doolittle did, was he invented, because he was actually a professor of aeronautical engineering, with the help of the government, he invented a number of instruments, very basic instruments, but there's still some form of these are still used in planes today, that would allow you to fly blind. And to prove it, he went out one day on Long Island, well, out of somewhere in Long Island, when the big fog moved in, and he pulled a canvas hood over the cockpit of his biplane. This is back in the early 1930s. He taxied and he took off and he flew for about 20 miles and he came back and he landed in a total under this canopy where all he could see was his instruments. And this was enormous. And it was the very beginning of commercial flight.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy that he tested it himself. He helped invent the altimeter, which allows you to know how high you are, the artificial horizon. I love how you describe the radar, like sort of the rudimentary radar they developed to let a pilot know.
Yeah, it was a radio signal. It was simply a signal that went out, and they had, you can hardly believe it, I would risk his life on this. There were two reeds, like you have it, like an oboe or something, a reed. And they sent out a radio signal from a beam from the airport. And you could tell how far away from the airport you were by the humming of these reeds as it received the signal. And so he knew when he was getting close, when the signal was louder and louder and louder. And then he'd look at his altimeter, and he'd look at his horizon, look at all whatever else he had, and somehow he was able to put down on a runway, and that's all he had. And it was an extremely bold thing to do, but he wanted to prove a point. He was always pushing that envelope.
Yeah, so by conquering the fog, he paved the way for aviation that we know today. Like, we're on a jumbo jet because of Doolittle.
Yeah, they had a hotelier in Paris had put up a big prize. I think it was like $50,000, which back then, it translates today, maybe $500,000, something like that. Many people had tried, and many people had died. And Lindbergh decided he was going to enter this contest just for the hell of it, see if he could do it. He had missed World War One, but he was in the Army, run into some Army flyers, I think, during the war, toward the end of the war. And they said, "Well, why don't you go and, you know, get in the airplane? You know, you got a plane, you can fly it, you know, get in the Army." So he did. He joined up in the reserves, and he flew. And then he decided he was going to enter this race, essentially designed his own plane after some fits and starts with trying to buy one, and took it to the race was from New York to Paris. You know, it wasn't from New York to Ireland. It had been done. But New York to Paris was a much longer distance. And just as he was getting ready to start his turn at it, to try, a handful of other flies, probably three or four, were trying to do it. They all died. Actually, some were grounded because they crashed and they didn't die, but they were hurt. The plane was hurt and so on. And he took off and he did it.
All the characters you follow in this book, I'm sure Charles Lindbergh is the most well known. And what's interesting is, you know, he's the first man to fly solo across the Atlantic. But I didn't realize this, or I should have realized this, that there was actually a race. Like, there's multiple people trying to achieve this goal. How were the other pilots going about this?
I think most important, in fact, he was going to do it solo. That the bet didn't say anything about solo, and people didn't think you could do it solo, because they said you fall asleep hours over the ocean and just that monotony of it. He decided what he was going to do is have a monoplane. Everybody else said, no, you got to have at least a biplane in case one of the engines conked out, because that was very common back then. One of the engines would stop and, you know, a pilot would put down a field or something, but if you're in the middle of the Atlantic, that's not possible. And so he decided he was going to get a big Curtiss-Wright engine and hope for the best, and he took every bit of weight, including he measured it down to the weight of a piece of paper, just a sheet of paper that he would scribble something on, eliminated all of the excess weight, and use it for gasoline, for fuel. He actually couldn't even see out of the car. He had fuel tanks ahead of him. Like, if you're sitting in a cockpit, normally you'd look out the front of the cockpit. Well, he couldn't do that. He had to stick his head out the side. But he said pilots did that anyway, and he didn't need to see what was ahead of him because he knew it was ahead of him, water.
What do you think, what was the difference? Like, how was Lindbergh's approach different from these other pilots and why was he successful when these other pilots failed? Was it just luck, or was it like the design of the plane?
Yeah, he was doing it without those kinds of instruments. He was, and if he had gotten, for instance, in a fog somewhere in over France, he would have been SOL, because, you know, fog is the most dangerous. I mean, I'm a sailor, and I can tell you the fog is the most hated thing anybody on the water, because you simply can't see where you are. There's no way to see. It's just you're in a fog is where you are. So anyway, his luck held out, and he flew all the way. He got to Paris. To his concern was he'd forgotten his wallet. He didn't have any money. And he's wondering if any place was going to be open where he could get something to eat, or how he was going to explain to some pension or somewhere cheap hotel he could stay that he would get money in the morning through American Express. And that was his big concern. If he reached England, he could see, he looked down, so he knew he was probably going to make it. But he was really worried about his circumstances when he got to Paris, because he was hungry. Anyway, he got there. He couldn't believe his eyes. And he saw these, he said, there must be some factory letting out, because he saw these thousands and thousands of headlights of cars. This is 1927. And he looked, he went, descended to the airfield. There were hundreds of thousands of people on the aerodrome. And he said, he didn't know where to land. They were on the runway. So he found a runway that wasn't being used and managed to land. And he got out of the plane, and all these people ran over to him and seized him. He was feared for his life, and they lifted him up on their shoulders and carried him around for a half an hour before some French pilots somehow rescued him and got him into a building, and he was then taken to the American Embassy and treated like a god. And it started there. This fame began there, and it never, ever ceased.
Right. Like, he was the first, like, modern, like, worldwide mega celebrity.
Yeah. I mean, like, the biggest rock star, the biggest athlete. You think back then, you know, we were in between the wars. The world was at peace. People needed heroes. And, of course, the press was big in that. The newspapers created the heroes. And so he was feted everywhere. He was, because it didn't hurt that he was a tall, handsome, good-looking, well-spoken young man, very humble, and just a pretty much everybody said an all-around good guy. But he was a mega hero.
But he didn't really respond well to the fame.
Well, Yeah, he didn't like all the celebrity. After a while, that can wear thin. And but he was not like these movie stars who won't give an autograph. He always had time to do these things. But his privacy, the trouble was he was so famous that his very privacy was often invaded. He didn't have any privacy. And, you know, of course, there was a horrible tragedy with his infant son who was kidnapped and murdered. The press they would literally camp out wherever he was, no matter where he went, when he was going to get married, when the press would be camped out by the bride's home. And always had to disguise when he went out. You know, he would lie in the back seat of the car. And that can wear thin on you after a while.
Yeah, for sure. Well, these three men in their 20s and early 30s, they made these fantastic contributions to aviation during and around World War I. But what's amazing about them is that when World War II broke out and the U.S. entered World War II, all three of them returned to service for their country as pilots.
Yeah, they'd taken their ball and gone home. I mean, they were too old for any kind of regular military service, and they were certainly well enough established and extremely wealthy, all of them, so they didn't have to do this, but they did it. And I think that in the regular service, because Doolittle was a regular Army colonel at that point, what they call the Army Air Corps then, belonged to the Department of the Army before they had an Air Force. And he was at the Pentagon. Well, this is before the Pentagon, wherever the hell the Army was based. And Roosevelt was a very, very, after Pearl Harbor, extremely adamant that we needed to strike back at Japan, and nobody knew how to do it because we had aircraft carriers, but we had fighter planes on them or fighter bombers, but they were not, they didn't have the range to strike Japan and get back to the carrier. And even if they had, they couldn't carry a payload of bombs that would be anything that would be meaningful. And one day, a naval captain discovered that the B-25 could fit on an aircraft carrier. And B-25 is what they call a medium-sized bomber, but it carried a payload that make a difference. And Hap Arnold, the head of the Air Force, assigned Doolittle to get up a squadron of these people and go and strike Japan. And he did, and he trained them, and he did all that, and then he announced that he was going with them. And they said, no way, you're too valuable to go with them. Well, he said, well, he was going to do it. And it was finagling that went on there, and he wound up leading this bunch. And it was an extremely bold thing that they did. Doolittle himself was, because he was so educated, he was an odds man, and he gave them himself and everybody else less than 50-50 chance that they were going to come back alive, because they had to go and get off the carrier, first of all, and nobody ever done that before with a full payload of bombs, of that kind of plane. And then they had to get to Japan. And it was said that Tokyo had 1,000 anti-aircraft weapons around, you know, a huge thing. And then they had to fly on from after that to airfields in China, which were supposed to have been prepared and weren't, in fact. And so everything seemed to go wrong. They took off from the carrier under duress because it had been spotted. They were supposed to take off 400 miles from Japan. They took off 700 miles from Japan. The seas were huge. They were just an awful storm, and the waves were as high as a 30-story building, and the deck of the carrier was pitching. It was like a seesaw. But anyway, they all got off somehow, performed their mission. They came in so low that the Japanese were so surprised they didn't expect this thing. And by the time they got to man their anti-aircraft guns and get their fighters off the ground, Doolittle raiders had hit their targets and gone on. But then the biggest problem came up with the weather turned really bad, and the night was falling. They were supposed to have landed in daytime, because of late they had landed at night. The weather was huge, and China, of course, is The coast is lime, but it's big mountain ranges that go way back into the interior. Nobody even knew how high they were because the maps couldn't be trusted. But they flew on, and finally, do a little radio to the other planes, just fly until you run out of gas and jump out. And that's what they did. And you imagine that wasn't scary. And because half of China was occupied by the Japanese, and they knew probably if they were caught by Japanese, they were going to be executed on the spot or taken to Tokyo and executed. As some were, in fact. But most of them, they jumped out, and there were 16 planes and I think about 80 flyers, and a couple of them were killed jumping out. They landed in the wrong place. A couple, a half a dozen more were captured by the Japanese, and some of those were executed. But the majority of them, by hook or by crook, somehow, with the help of the Chinese people, were taken back to U.S. lines there and flown home. And Doolittle, he was mortified because he thought he was going to be court-martialed because he lost all the planes. His whole squadron of planes was crashed and burned. And he got back to Washington finally. It was a big circuitous route through India. And he didn't even have proper clothes on. And General Marshall, who was the chief of staff of the Army, called him in and he said, "We're going to the White House." And Doolittle said, "What for?" He said, "The president is going to give you the Congressional Medal of Honor," which he did. So that was the story of the Doolittle Raid. Of course, Doolittle became very, very famous after that.
Wow, and this was Doolittle's raid.
Well, the interesting thing about Doolittle is, and the reason I wrote this book the way I did, I was going to do a biography of Doolittle. Nobody had done it. He wrote an autobiography, but I got about a third of the way into it. And I said, now I know why nobody's done a biography of Doolittle, because the raid itself, which happened in 1942, was the biggest thing in the biography, even though, interestingly enough, he became the commanding general of every Air Force we had in the Atlantic Theater. When we invaded North Africa, he was the commander of the 12th Air Force. And we invaded Italy, he was the commander of the 15th Air Force. We invaded Normandy, the European continent, he was commander of the 8th Air Force. Huge, important positions. But the problem with it was Eisenhower had forbade him to fly because he knew about ULTRA, which was the top secret code-breaking operation going on in Great Britain. And they were afraid that if the Germans got him to somehow torture him, cause him to reveal this, that would all be blown. And so his work was basically administrative, even though it was great work. But he lived on until he was like 95. And so I got right, and I said, you know, this book, I can't write this book. It's going to be dull. I said, I wish to heck he had crashed in the Pacific like Eddie Rickenbacker had. And then I thought, wait a minute, I started having an epiphany. And I said, wait a minute, how about if I write about Doolittle and Rickenbacker? And then I had another epiphany right on top of that. I said, wait a minute. If I add Lindbergh, I've got the three greatest flyers of the 20th century. If I take all three of them, they all knew each other. They were all World War I products one way or the other. And they all did, you know, their thing early on in their 20s. Well, except for Doolittle, but he raced and did all that then. And then they all went on to World War II. I said, this is a really good story here. So that's how I came to write the book.
Yeah, so start off with Doolittle. Yeah, and like going to Rickenbacker, like that was phenomenal too. Like he was this celebrity hero, wealthy, went back and he got shot down in the Pacific and he was a castaway, like in the middle of the ocean in a lifeboat.
This guy. So. He wasn't actually shot down. He was in a B-17, and they were going to. He had some special message to tell General MacArthur, who was in New Guinea, and they took off in his B-17, and for a variety of reasons, including some navigational problems, they ran out of gas, and they had to put a B-17 down in an ocean with 12-foot seas. It's never been done before successfully, anyway. And they did, and they got out in these little life rafts, and the plane sunk almost immediately. And they had three life rafts, and this was early on in the war before the Air Corps realized what they needed to put in the life rafts. And so they had some fishing poles and hooks, but no bait. They had, you know, no water, no food, no, just the barest stuff. And they, it was kind of life raft where one guy has to turn over, everybody's got to turn over. And so they went for like a week with no food, no water. People were literally dying. I mean, and all of a sudden, Rickenback is sitting there and a seagull land on his head. And because everybody stared, they're looking at that seagull, that's lunch. And he slowly, slowly reached back as carefully as he could. He seized that bird and wrung its neck, and they divided it up. He had a good sense, though, to keep the entrails for bait. And so they then began to catch some fish, and that got them through. But on they went for week after week until the Air Force was going to give up the search because they don't search. They have a certain amount of time. That's 2 weeks, I think, is it. And Mrs. Rickenbacker stormed down from New York to Washington and stormed into Hap Arnold's office. He's the head of the Air Force, and don't you dare give up this search. And so they put it on for another week or however long it was, and suddenly one of these search planes looked down and he saw one of the life rafts anyway. They got them finally. They, you know, emaciated and sunburned, horribly sunburned, and water, you know, the sores that you get when you're in that kind of situation. But Rickenbacker spent a week putting himself back together, and then he flew on back to New Guinea to give MacArthur his message. He was tough.
So again, it's that tenacity that they had from the get-go. And he was, again, he was in his 40s when this was going on too.
Well, he was in his 50s.
50s, okay.
I believe he was in his 50s. Early 50s.
Right. And again, like,
if I'm not mistaken.
He didn't have to do this. He could have been just enjoying the
Oh, no,
the
he
high
didn't
life.
Have to do it.
Right.
And he kept on going. He would go out to North Africa. His solid job. They offered him a rank of a lieutenant general. And he said, no, I don't want that. He said, I'm going to be Captain Eddie. So I don't want to get in the military with all that hierarchy. People, even lieutenant generals have people telling them what to do. He said, I'm going to do it my way. And his job was sort of, he would go out to these various pilots units. And these were all young pilots. I mean, they weren't professional pilots. They were young men in their 20s who had taken a pilot training. But here's, you know, Rickenbacker, he was one of the gods, like Little in Lindbergh. And he would go there to various bases and give him a, he knew how to give a pep talk. He was very adept at that.
Well, let's talk about Lindbergh, because he is an interesting case, because it took him a while to come to his country's service during World War II. Both Rickenbacker and Doolittle, even before World War II, were making a big push for aviation in the military, which kind of fell on deaf ears until Pearl Harbor. So can you talk a little bit about Lindbergh and why it took him a bit to come to his country's aid?
Yeah, he was a colonel by that time in the Army, and he was on the reserve list. He wasn't active. He was very much opposed to the U.S. entry into World War II. And I think some of that was a product of his upbringing as essentially an isolationist. And that sprang from World War I, where we sent, you know, 2 or 3 million troops to France, to Europe, and had 50,000 of them killed. And what, 20 years later, they had it again. And the isolationist movement was very strong. Lindbergh's father was a great isolationist. He just said, let Europe have its own problems. We don't need it. And so he joined an organization called America First. Rickenbacker was in the same organization for a long time. And it said, basically, it's America First. And what that meant was that they said, spend their defense money, but spend it on defense of this country. So that if Germany does, in fact, which it appeared, this, if you look now, we're talking 1939, 40, 41. It appeared that Germany was going to take over all of Europe. From 39 on, early 40 on, Great Britain was the only ally there was. The rest of them had been conquered, France and all the lowland countries and Scandinavia. Everybody was under the thumb of the Germans except for the Soviet Union. And Lindbergh had been there a number of times, been to Germany, been to Great Britain, and he was of the opinion, looking at the German Air Force, that they were far superior to anything that Great Britain had. He became one of the major spokesmen for this America First, which infuriated Roosevelt, President Roosevelt. And Roosevelt had cast doubts on his loyalty because, of course, he was of German extraction. And that caused Lindbergh to renounce his colonelcy in the Army. He said, I can't serve for a man who thinks I'm disloyal. And he wasn't disloyal. In any case, when the war came, when we got into war, Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt had a long memory, and Lindbergh had gone back and begged. I always say begged, but he asked very politely. He'd like to have his commission back. And the word came everywhere, no. And not only came his commission, but even where he worked, he wanted to work in aviation, and wherever he worked, the Roosevelt administration had threatened to pull the government contracts from his companies. And the only person that Roosevelt couldn't stand up to was Henry Ford, who at that point had the largest aircraft manufacturing operation in the world at Willow Run, making warplanes. And so they hired Lindbergh on, as he was a technician. He was essentially a test pilot. And he did things that very few pilots, with the exception, say, of Doolittle, would have done. I mean, high-altitude stuff and pushing the limits on planes. And finally, in 1943, I believe it was, he went to Henry Ford and said, look, I've done all I can do here with testing these aircraft. He said, I need to go and test them under the conditions on which they were designed, meaning combat conditions. And in particular, he wanted to test two airplanes they did. The Navy had a single-engine fighter plane that they used off aircraft carriers and off the islands with the Marine Corps. And the Army was using a twin-engine plane, a P-40, two booms, and it's a funny-looking thing. But that's what the Army was using, MacArthur. And so, indeed, he did. He went out, and they gave him there was a special kind of designation they gave me. He was neither fish nor fowl. He dressed up with an officer's uniform, and he ate in the officer's mess, and he was accorded the officer's privileges, very much like a newspaper reporter, but he was essentially a technician. And so he went to, of all places, Guadalcanal, and studied planes. These were Navy planes. And he then went up island to Bougainville and all those places. He flew with with Foss, who was the most famous Marine Corps ace in World War II. And he started flying combat missions with him, and they all liked him. So he's a good guy. And he gave him a lot of good tips and things. He was, again, the most famous aviator of his age. Not to be outdone, he then went to New Guinea, and he started flying with these guys. And so he flew with the best-known air group there was. I can't remember the name of it, 434th or something like that. But he walked into the pilot shack there, and there was the commander, who was probably in his 20s. He was a colonel, and he said who he was. And the guy was playing checkers. He walked in behind him. He said who he was and what he wanted. He said, I want to fly with your group and study your aircraft. And the guy sort of waved him off. And so he waited for about 4, 5, 6 minutes. And finally, the colonel said, now, what did you say your name was, and what did you want? Again, and he told him his name, and he told him what he wanted, and the guy turned around. He said, not Charles Lindbergh, my God. And so he became ingratiated with this group, and he began flying these combat missions, and he showed them something that they didn't know, how to change the mixture of the fuel that would give them an extra 600-mile range. Everybody was extremely appreciative of this, because that was part of the problem with these islands being distant. You know, MacArthur was moving up from New Guinea toward the Philippines and later Japan. In order to send his bombers, his B-17 bombers, they needed escorts. And the fighters just didn't have the fuel range. Well, suddenly Lindbergh had given them a range. And then one day a notice comes to him to immediately report to MacArthur's headquarters. And he figures he's in for it. Because he's not supposed to be flying with these people. He's a technician. And certainly he's also Lindbergh. He was anathema to Roosevelt. So he goes to MacArthur's headquarters, and MacArthur greets him like a long-lost brother. And he told him he's given him this enormous range that they get 600 more miles. That's coming and going. 300-mile range, I guess. And they could fly there and fly back there. 600 miles of flying time, I meant to say. But anyway, he continued to do that and actually flew more missions. And he shot down a Jap Zero and almost got shot down himself. And He flew more than was required by the Army. And then he came home. So he'd done his duty.
That's funny. He found a way to serve.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, as you were researching and writing about these men, did you pick up any life lessons that you think men today can take from?
Well, yeah, and you do it in all the histories that I've written. I mean, it's perseverance. It's somehow the ability to put your own life on the line, the ability to somehow conquer fear, put the fear, compartmentalize it, put it somewhere else, because all these things require a certain amount of fortitude. And once you conquer that, once you get that under control, then it's perseverance, because none of these things are easy that these guys did. I mean, you think of Doolittle putting himself in that situation where he's got a canvas cover over his cockpit. He can't see anything but the instrument panel. It's looking right at him. That's all he can see. And he's going to take that thing up in the air that way? I mean, that required a lot of fortitude, but also it took him years. I can't remember, not many, many years, because he had a lot of help from the Bureau of Standards and other things. But they perfected these instruments. I mean, he went out to the finest watchmakers and other people who knew how to do precision instruments and make them small and precise. It was a big risk, but it was also the years that it took him to get those things just right. And the same thing was true for Lindbergh. I mean, all these guys were, there's a very thin margin in aviation between life and death. My conversation with my friend, the fighter pilot, last night, he'd just been in Afghanistan. And it's very thin. And there's a lot of unknowables, like who's going to shoot at you, you know, and when. But those are risks that you take. It goes with the territory. These guys were willing to take the risk and willing to put their lives on the line, but they were also very smart guys who had a great instincts for self-preservation, but also great instincts as to what it took to be an American. And I think that is a trait that is not necessarily unique to this country, but it's unique to a lot more people in this country, and it seems to be any other place in the world. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Well, Winston Groom, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. My guest today was Winston Groom. He's the author of several books. Go to Amazon.com, search Winston Groom. You're going to find all sorts of great books. He's got a ton of them on there, including history books and historical fiction. You can find more information about his work at WinstonGroom.com. The book we talked about today was Aviators, and his latest historical fiction book is El Paso. So go check that out. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/aviators, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. If you enjoy this show, I'd appreciate if you take 1 or 2 minutes to give us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, whatever it is you use to listen to podcasts. Please give us a review. That helps us out a lot. As always, thank you for your continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.